That is a very good summary, I must say. The point I want to emphasize is that the concept of value comes to express a social property of all commodities. What is common to the most different commodities, which differ entirely from one another in terms of the natural, physical, and chemical properties, and yet are all the time being compared and equated in the process of commodity production and exchange. And that commonality is the fact that they are all the result of the expenditure of some proportion of society's total labor time. This is what makes them commensurable. This is the common quality of all of them. And when we say this, we're obviously abstracting from the different kinds of labor that go into the production of various commodities. Therefore, we are talking about labor in general and not about any specific kind of labor. So, to summarize, you can say that the use value aspect of a commodity corresponds to a specific kind of labor that leads to it being produced. The value aspect of a commodity refers to the fact that every commodity is the product of human labor in general. It doesn't arrive from the heavens. It is a product of human labor acting upon materials furnished by nature. But this particular value form, the notion that commodities have this quality of social property of being values, is specific to the system of commodity production and capitalism. It is not true of earlier epochs. You wouldn't have talked about, for example, if an ancient society, you had sharpened a piece of stone and used it to hunt an animal, you would call that sharpened piece of stone a means of, you know, labor or instrument of production, if you like, but you wouldn't call it capital. The term capital acquires relevance only under the capitalist mode of production. So, you know, categories in Marxism always have to be historically specific. Like that, value is a category that is specific to the era of commodity production. Commodities are values in the sense that they're all products of society's labor time. This is the qualitative aspect. In order to be able to say this, you have to abstract from the different kinds of labor that are performed. And that becomes possible only under capitalism, where labor is in fact mobile and going across different kinds of activities over a period of time. So, you know, these points are elaborated in the chapter. So in the lectures I'm giving you, I will not be able to go into every aspect of what I'm saying. So I would urge that the lectures are only an aid to reading the chapters. Lectures are not by themselves standalone material. I mean, they're useful. They give you a certain organized presentation of the material in the book, but go read the chapters. Otherwise, you will not be able to take full advantage of whatever presentation I make here. In this class today, and possibly the next, depending on how much progress we make today, we will look at a very fundamental question of capitalism, namely, how does one explain a very elementary fact of capitalism, which is, you know, as capitalism goes on, you find that a smaller and smaller proportion of society becomes increasingly the biggest players in the game. They control the means of production, they control distribution, they control prices, and therefore the wealth of capitalist society accumulates in fewer and fewer hands. On the other hand, those who produce the wealth of society, working people, with the help of natural resources and, of course, products of past labor in the form of the instruments of production, they remain where they are. They may make some progress in terms of rise in living standards over a long historical period, but they don't, as a class, come to control society or its means of production or its processes. How does capitalism reproduce itself in the way that workers remain where they are, by and large, and capitalists get fewer and fewer capitalists, become more and more powerful? Some of these things will become clear as we go along, but in a sense, you know, this is the underlying problematic, if you like. So let's put it this way. Let's make it simpler and begin by asking the question, all right, we all know that capitalism is driven by profit. Okay, there are three basic features of capitalism. It may vary from country to country in some other respects, but the three basic features would be, one, as we discussed last time, capitalism is a society of generalized commodity production, meaning that practically all things produced under capitalism or produced not for own use but for sale in a market on private account. Of course, there are exceptions. The food you cook at home is not a commodity. That's outside the commodity sphere. But by and large, 99% practically of all that we consume is basically produced in a process where production is for the market and not for own use. In fact, there's much more that one can talk about this. But today, given the constraints of time, I won't go into it. Go back and read the chapter carefully. So the first point, therefore, is that capitalism is a society of generalized commodity production where practically everything is produced with a view to sale on private account in a market. Number two, as opposed to earlier commodity producing societies, what is specific to capitalism is that labor power itself becomes a commodity. Number three, that this whole process of producing commodities for sale in the market is not an act of charity. It is driven by the need to make profits. So capitalism is a profit-driven economic system. So the question to ask is, where does this profit come from? You see, what you must recognize is that there's something very fundamentally different in capitalism when you compare it to pre-capitalist societies. In slavery, it's clearly evident that the master exploits the slave. The entire time of the slave is the master's. Master decides how the slave will dispose of his labor time. Even the family of the slave is bonded to the master. So there it is obvious that the labor of the slave is directly exploited by the owner. Likewise, under feudalism, when the peasant works under the feudal lord, he works a part of the time on his little allotment land, but a part of the time on the landlord's estate. And as Marx remarks in his usual and brilliantly sarcastic manner, either the peasant works 3 days for himself, 3 days for his lord on earth, who is the feudal lord, and the seventh day he works for the lord above, which is Sabbath, Sunday. I mean, it's Marx's way of putting this point sharply across. But in both these cases, both in slave society and in feudal society, the fact of exploitation is explicit. Labor time of the slave, the entire disposal of labor time of the slave is not in the hands of the slave, but it is in the hands of the master. In the case of the peasant under feudalism also, only a portion of labor time is disposed of by the peasant himself. The rest of it is determined by the landlord requiring him to work for the estate, on the estate. But capitalism is very different because capitalism has this illusion that all individuals have the freedom to decide how to dispose of their labor power. Under capitalism, in theory, it might sound absurd when I say it, in theory, our poor migrant worker who is desperately seeking to run to his village and Mukesh Ambani are equal before the law. This is the absurdity of capitalism, that it has this fiction that we are all legally equal. And therefore, the worker is presumed to confront the capitalist as a seller of a commodity. What is the commodity he's selling? His labor power. He's not bound to work for a particular capitalist. He's free. He's a free wage laborer. He's free to work for anybody of his choice. But as we saw last time, he's also free to remain unemployed and starve. So in a sense, he must necessarily find an employer. But the point is that an illusion is created whereby the worker is seen as an individual on the same footing, legally speaking, as the employer. So here, the question of exploitation becomes much more complex. It's far from obvious. It's obvious in the case of the serf. It's obvious in the case of the slave. But in the case of the modern wage worker, there is a contract that the worker enters into with the capitalist. You work for me, I pay you so much. Done. It's an explicit and voluntary agreement. Of course, behind that voluntary agreement is the fact that the worker has no other access to livelihood. He's been deprived of the means of production. He's been alienated from the means of production. But that's something that we don't focus on, right? We just take it for granted that you're born into a household, you grow up, and you go to work. So going to work is taken as a given, as a natural phenomenon in society. This is always very important because any existing society generates the illusion that it is natural and eternal. whereas in fact it's being undermined all the time, and something will replace it at some point in time. But given that it is regarded as quote unquote natural for people to go and work for somebody else, we do not see directly that the worker is being exploited by the capitalist. This is something that requires a scientific explanation under capitalism, unlike in the case of pre-capitalist modes of production, such as feudalism and slavery. So in a sense, what we're going to try and do today is to try and unravel the process by which the capitalist is able to get profits, and what is it that makes it possible for this to happen is something we're going to look at today. So let's now come back to two different circuits that we see most familiarly under capitalism. Now, for most of us under capitalism, we go work for somebody, we get a wage or a salary, and we meet our requirements month after month from the money that we earn in this manner. So what are we doing? We are selling a commodity, C, which is labor power. In other words, the commodity I'm selling to the capitalist is my labor power. I get a sum of money for that act of sale of my labor power. And with the money I get various commodities that I require over a month's time till I get my next monthly salary, if I'm a monthly paid person. So the circuit I'm involved in is what you may call CMC dash, circuit of commodities. Start with a commodity labor power, sell it to an employer. He or she gives me a wage or a salary. In fact, even that is not quite true, because I work for a month before I get paid. I'm advancing money to the capitalist. Let's leave that aside. Let's assume that I'm getting paid as I go to work. So at the end of the month, I've exhausted my salary, right? So I have to again go back to work in order to survive, to sustain myself. So here the circuit is CMC dash. It's very important, because CMC dash is a circuit driven by the need for the worker to reproduce himself. It is not driven by some dream of becoming the owner of big companies. So it is driven by the needs of consumption and survival and reproduction. Therefore, it is a very limited dynamism. CMC dash, worker sells labor power, gets salaries, spends it, and goes back to work again and again. The worker or the office employee or whatever, or even the high-tech IT professional. So this is a circuit. CMC prime is a circuit where there is no drive for continuous expansion. It is simply a necessity of survival that makes you go through the circuit again and again and again. And this is valid for 90% or more of the population under capitalism. But there is the other small part who are not wage workers or salaried employees or petty self-employed people as in India, but who are basically employers, capitalists, the owners of the means of production. In their case, the circuit is a very different one. What is the circuit that drives capitalism? Not the worker circuit, which is selling labor power, getting a salary, and then buying whatever you need, you know, groceries, vegetables, pay rent, and, you know, pay for your education, etc., etc. No, that's not what drives capitalism. What drives capitalism is the possibility of making profit. So the circuit that really matters under capitalism is what you may call the circuit of capital, where the starting point is money. Capitalist lays out money, then he does so hoping that he would end the process with more money than he began with. So MCM prime, start money, you lay it out. How do we go from an initial outlay of money that is advanced by the capitalist to the capitalist getting more money, but receiving a surplus through some process? I don't like to use the word earn for this particular process. Work means that you earn your wage. Capitalist profit is an outcome of property ownership, not of any work. The work is done by the worker. The profit goes to the capitalist on account of his or her ownership of the means of production. If you object saying, what about capitalists who also work? Of course, you know, the CEO can be, his salary can be included in the work part, in the wages part, but the surplus goes in the profit part. So it's not like it's impossible to understand this. So we can say that the circuit of capital is MCM dash, where you start with money and the object of the process is to end with more money. In other words, the initial and end points are the same form, money form. Now, historically, how did this happen? Historically, the most familiar form of acquiring more money from initial outlay was through money lending. It's the easiest, right? How does money expand in the hands of the usurer or the money lender? So money lending capital, usurious capital, is one of the earliest forms of capital in history, where money seems to beget more money by some mysterious process. You'll find that all the religions carry injunctions against usurious money lending, confirming the fact that this must have existed across all religions. So early human historical development in the transition from earlier times to modern capitalism has seen this practice of money lending. So historically, first, most familiar and earliest form of capital, circuit of capital, is MM prime, where money lending gives you more money at the end of the period. The second, better known form of capital would be trading. You buy something somewhere, you sell something, same thing somewhere else. You buy at a lower price and sell at a higher price. So MCM prime. With money, you buy a commodity. Then that commodity you sell. And in this process, you make a gain. Now, both money lending capital and merchant capital have one common property. What one party gains, the other party or parties lose. If I am gaining interest by lending money usuriously or whatever rate of interest I lend it at, I get the interest. The other party doesn't get anything. So there is an unequal exchange. I gave 100 rupees. I got back 110 rupees. And this 10 rupees is interest, right? There's nothing equivalent that the other person gets. This 10 is only obtained by extracting it from the other party. There's nothing being created here. No good is being created. No wealth is being created. Simply a transaction that takes away some money from the other person and gives it to me as interest. Likewise with trading, you can say that I'm a smart guy who buys cheap and sells dear, but that means that the other guy who sold to me didn't sell me at the right price that he could have sold it at. And the guy who bought it from me paid more than he needs to have paid. So if you take the three of us together, the initial seller who sold it to me and then the buyer who bought it from me, taking the three of us together, there's no gain. I have gained at the expense of the other two. Nothing has been produced. This is simply a gain exchange transaction between three people taken two at a time. I buy from A, then I sell to B. In these transactions, there is nothing being created or produced, but only exchanges occurring. And therefore, this is also something that can explain why some people become richer, but will not explain the process by which production itself expands and additional assets are created, real physical assets are created. So in order for that to happen, and that is the characteristic of capitalism, that it constantly creates new assets and new means of production and new products and so on, you obviously must look not at money lending capital, nor at merchant capital, both of which are historically earlier forms of capital, but you must look at the most relevant form of capital for the age of capitalism, which is productive or industrial capital. And here, of course, when I say industrial capital, it includes agriculture also as an industry. It's not industry in the sense of non-agriculture, but productive capital, capital that goes into productive creation of wealth, productive use of resources. So you can think of this in terms of a capitalist typically would lay out some money on, say, renting in the factory or leasing in a factory. He would purchase labor power, he'd hire employees, pay them wages, keep them there. He would purchase raw materials from other capitalists, and then he would put all this to work. The raw materials will be processed by the workers in the factory to result in a new product. So here you can think of starting with money, going purchasing two distinct kinds of commodities, namely labor power on the one hand, which is the more active element in production, and the other means of production, including machinery, raw materials, etc., setting them to work. You generate a production process. You end up with a new commodity, which you then sell for a certain price. So here, you start with money. Then you lay it out in terms of distinct kinds of inputs to the production process. You buy raw materials. You either build a factory or lease in a factory for which you pay rent to the owner. You use machines, which you have bought from other capitalists. But you employ living labor. Transform the raw materials using the machinery into a new product, which then you sell. So here, there is a process of creation. Production is there. There is a process of production, not merely of exchange. So this is the typical form of the circuit of capital under capitalism. Question then becomes, how does the initial outlay of money end up being higher at the end of the process? What is the secret, in other words, of this surplus value that accrues to the capitalist? I mean, when I say accrues to the capitalist, I'm simplifying, because tomorrow the capitalist may have to share as part of the surplus by paying rent to the landlord who came in the factory. A commission agent will take some money. So capitalists may not get all of this, but there is a surplus being produced over and above what is spent on the purchase of raw materials, machines, and the hiring of labor power. So where is the surplus coming from? Where is the surplus value coming from? And this is where Marx made a fundamental contribution, because he was the one who distinguished between labor and labor power. You know, we all perform labor, right? When you go into the factory, you perform labor. But what are you selling the capitalists? You're selling your labor power. Now, this is important because, you know, in a sense, you can think of it this way. How do you understand labor power? You go in the morning, you go to factory fresh. You work for the whole day. You are exhausted by the end of the day. So your labor power has been used and you expended a certain amount of energy during the working day and you come out tired. You know, it's a bit like markets where you see sugar cane, right? Cane that we buy, which is crushed by the small machine that the poor fellow in the bus stand has, and then he gives you the juice. So the worker is like a fresh cane going into the factory and comes out crushed at the end of the day, with the difference that the crushed cane cannot be made back into the original cane, but the crushed worker can be given rest and food and shelter and come back fresh the next day to work. So labor power must be understood, therefore, in terms of the bundle of physical and mental energies that the worker sells the capitalist. And this is something that Marx's discovery and the use of the concept of labor power is very fundamental, because it's enabled him to go beyond Smith and Ricardo, who also subscribe to what they call a labor theory value. They also recognize that value is created by labor. The commodities possess value because they are products of labor. They didn't quite put it in the terms that Marx put it, but they had a rough labor theory value which said that surplus occurs from the application of human labor to production, not from anything else. Unlike modern economists who try to completely obfuscate the source of surplus value. Smith himself generalized from earlier economists like the physiocrats, who were focused on agricultural labor alone being productive. Smith generalized it. Ricardo also followed Smith. But Marx was able to go beyond them by focusing on the concept of labor power as opposed to just labor. So under capitalism, the capitalist purchases raw materials, he purchases machinery, he rents in or purchases or builds a factory and other necessary means of production, but he also purchases labor power. Now, if you go back to what we discussed in the other class, that commodities exchange at their values as a hypothesis, starting hypothesis, we take it that commodities exchange at their values. Therefore, the capitalist would have to pay the worker the value of labor power. We don't assume that the capitalist cheats the worker. We assume the capitalist buys labor power at its value. In other words, he pays the worker the value of labor power. What is that? What is that? Is something we'll come to in a minute. Likewise, he buys the raw material and other things exactly in the same manner. There's no cheating involved. All exchange takes place at the in proportion to the values of the commodities. Okay, amount of labor time required to produce them. Remember, the value of a commodity is the socially necessary labor time required to produce it. And this is what governs the exchange of commodities as per our hypothesis. So that's where we are right now. Now, therefore, the capitalist buys raw materials, other means of production from other capitalists. We assume that he pays full value for those purchases. He doesn't cheat the others. Likewise, he buys labor power from the worker. We assume he pays the worker the full value of labor power. He may or may not, but let's assume that he does. So then the question that arises is, what is the value of labor power? How do you visualize it? As in the case of other commodities, here also, when you say labor power is a commodity, its value must necessarily be the socially necessary labor time required to produce labor power. As with all other commodities, right? Generally, when you say, what is the value of a commodity? First of all, you say the qualitative aspect is that the commodities are products of society's labor time. That's a qualitative aspect. But the quantitative aspect is that the amount of value, the magnitude of value of a commodity is the amount of socially necessary labor time required to produce it. This applies as much to labor power. So the question to ask is, what is this amount of socially necessary labor time required to produce labor power? Now, Marx makes a very important point here in the discussion, where he says, unlike, and I'm quoting him from memory, unlike in the case of other commodities, there enters into the determination of the value of labor power, a moral and historical element. Now, what does Marx mean by this? Something very important. We're not going to elaborate a great deal on this, but the point is important because Marx is not saying that the worker's wage is some kind of a biological minimum. He's not saying that. He's saying whatever wage is given to the worker must be sufficient to enable the worker to reproduce himself and his household so that you have a continuous supply of labor power for the capitalist class, of course. But at what level? Now, this is going to be historically specific. For example, you compare, let's say, rise of capitalism in Europe, which occurs on the ashes of feudalism, so to speak. So there already urban settlements have emerged, urban manufacturers have emerged, and the modern industrial working class is recruited from these urban manufacturers. Whereas you take a country like India under colonial rule, after a century of deindustrialization, people being driven to the countryside under colonial rule, when industrial expansion emerges in the late 1850s, 1860s, you have this mass of rural working people swarming to get some job in the urban center. So the extremely miserable conditions of existence in the countryside determine what is seen as an acceptable wage for reproducing the labor power, which of course means they live shorter lives, they live lives mortal, you know, considerable morbidity and so on. But the point here is very simple, that you must understand that unlike in the case of other commodities, as far as labor power is concerned, socially necessary labor time includes a certain historical and moral element as to what is considered appropriate in that society. Obviously, over time, over centuries, as workers become more organized and more powerful, they end up forcing society to revise the conception of what is an appropriate wage for the working class. Obviously, that happens as well. So, in that sense, there is always a historical and moral element to the value of labor power. That enters into the determination of the value of labor power, a historical and moral element. Now, this is something you can go back and reflect on this later. It's not very central to our argument. But the point that we need to take from this discussion so far is that it is possible to identify the value of labor power, meaning the amount of labor time required to reproduce labor power. Most countries do publish statistics, right? Bureau of Labor Statistics in the US, for example, publishes data on what is required for a working class family of four for 1 month. What is the expenditure required to be met? So in a sense, you get an implicit assessment of the amount of socially necessary labor time required to produce all those objects which directly or indirectly enter into the consumption of the working class household and therefore into its reproduction. And this is not something purely biological minimum, but it is also determined by specific historical and moral contexts. Okay, now with this understanding that labor power is a commodity, and therefore, it is a specific value in any given setting, namely the amount of labor time required to produce all those goods and services which are required by a working class family for its survival and reproduction. With that understanding, we can proceed further. Now, let's look at the production process in capitalism from the standpoint of the relationship between the two classes. Note that I'm not talking about a capitalist, a worker, a factory. No, I'm talking about looking at society as a going concern and looking at the two basic classes, the capitalist class on the one side and the working class on the other. Now, what do we see? Year after year, workers produce society's output. And when I say workers, I mean intellectual workers, manual workers, everybody, right up to the CEO, as long as the CEO is working, right? We're not saying that they exclude managers from this. Because, it's a bit tough because managers do two things. One, they do what is necessary for production. Two, they also enforce the power of the boss. So there's a problem there. But let's, for the time being, assume that everybody in the workplace, right up to the highest managerial person, producing, working, laboring, and so on. If you take society as a whole and see it in terms of these two broad classes, the capitalist class, which owns the means of production, and people who work to earn their bread. Year after year, the working class produces society's output using the means of production owned by the capitalist class. What do they get in return for this? They get a share of the output as wages. Okay, that is one part of the output. It goes as wages, using which workers buy whatever they need. As if they're being given coupons to buy a part of what they have produced, collectively speaking. A part of the output goes to replace the used up means of production, depreciation, all of that. But the rest is surplus. After you have replaced raw material used, the depreciation that has occurred to the machinery, and the reproduction of labor power is accounted for, then what remains is surplus. And that surplus does not come to the workers because they don't own the factories. They don't own the means of production. So that surplus comes to the capitalists, landlords, and other owners of the means of production. Now, this is what we see around us. We see year after year, instead of getting into, you know, technical arguments and formal equations, a sense of what happens in the capitalism is that, you know, as time goes on, one capitalist actually may end up being owner of 10, 12, 30 factories after a while. Of course, 10 other capitalists may have become bankrupt by then. That's a different matter. But there is a class of people who work. There's a class of people who are the owners of the factories and other productive enterprises who get to appropriate the product. And a part of the product goes into replacing used up raw material, replacing used up depreciated machinery, but a part of it also goes to, you know, replace labor power, I mean, reproduce labor power. The rest is surplus, which goes to the owning classes. Now, how does this occur? What is this process by which the surplus is thus produced and appropriated under capitalism? Produced by the working class, but appropriated by capital. So for this, we need to look at the labor process under capitalism. Okay. Here it is important. Why? Because why Marx looks at it in this manner? Why does he foreground labor, living labor, as the key to production? The first thing about the labor process, as such, under all circumstances, not just under capitalism, is that the labor process is a process in which human being interacts with nature. And through such interaction, we change the world around us, and in the process, we change ourselves as well. So the first point that Marx makes is that in the labor process, and I would, each time I can't say man slash woman, so I will say man, but take it that it means human beings. In the labor process, the man, a man or a woman, whoever is doing this labor process, is engaging in conscious and purposive activity. Marx describes it like this. Marx describes the labor process. He says, in the labor process, I'm quoting now, in the labor process, man's activity, with the help of the instruments of labor, effects an alteration designed from the commencement, conscious purposive activity, designed from the commencement in the material worked upon. This process of labor disappears into the product. Right? Once the product is there, the labor has disappeared, right? Living labor which made this possible has disappeared. That which in the laborer, and I'm quoting, that which in the laborer appeared as movement, now appears in the product as a fixed quality without motion. If we examine the whole process from the point of view of the result, it is plain that both the instruments and the subject of labor, raw materials, are the means of production, and that the labor itself, the living labor, is productive labor. In other words, the production is made possible not by the inanimate means of production, raw materials and machinery and so on, but production is made possible by the living labor of the worker. This is what creates value. This is what is key to the whole process of transformation of raw materials into products. After all, we kept, as I said in the last class, we kept cotton on a table, and the machine that would spin yarn from cotton, but didn't bring them together through a worker, they would remain exactly where they are. So it is the living laborer who transforms the raw material into a product using machinery, and in the process, his labor disappears into the product. Okay. Now, so what does this mean? I mean, so therefore, under the capitalist labor process, if you look at the whole process, the laborer is alienated in a double sense. We talk about alienation a lot, especially sociologists too. But Marx has a very specific notion of alienation, not some anthropomorphic notion of alienation from some pristine nature of human beings as such. But what he does talk about, you know, what is specific to the human species, namely conscious purposive activity, that is certainly there, but it's not an ahistoric concept. So in the capitalist production process, the laborer is alienated from the control of the labor process, because the purpose of the activity and the control of the worker's own activity are determined by the capitalist. So he's alienated from the process of labor. That's number one. But equally importantly, the product now belongs to the capitalist, not to the worker. Although the worker has produced it, he has used the instruments given by the capitalist and raw material provided by the capitalist. The product belongs to the capitalist. The capitalist has paid the worker wages. Therefore, the product belongs to the capitalist. So the worker is alienated both from the process of labor and from the product of labor. That's something that, you know, keep it as a matter to understand and reflect upon in the background. I'm not going to expand on this now. But let's come back to how Marx views the labor process. So here's what he says, you know, and I'm not quoting, but I'm summarizing. The active element in the labor process, namely the living labor of the worker, does three things. What does it do? One, it preserves the value of the raw material in the product. It transfers value from the raw material into the product fully. Two, it transfers a portion of the value of the machine to the product, because the machine depreciates over time. So for each product, each day's product, it lends a certain part of the machine is being consumed in the process of one day's production. Third, one full day of labor time has been additionally expended in comparison to where you were at the starting point of the working day. So living labor not only preserves the value of the raw material in the product, not only transfers a portion of the value of the machine to the product, but it also adds fresh value to the product by direct labor for the whole working day. So the capitalist labor process is not only a process of production of value, because at the end of it, you get a commodity which is embodied labor time in it. But don't forget that the whole rationale for the capitalist labor process is to make surplus. So the labor process is not only a process of production of value, but also of surplus value. Now, to answer the question that we began with, how is surplus value created? We must now move from the passive elements of the labor process, namely the means of production, the raw materials, and the instruments of labor, to the active element, living labor. This is where the secret of surplus value is to be found, and that's what Marx demonstrates brilliantly. I mean, I'm of course summarizing a huge argument in the course of just 5 to 10 minutes, so you will have to go back and read, as I said, my text and the corresponding part of Marx's Capital. But the point here is, if you want to understand how surplus value is created, you don't focus on the raw material and on the instruments of labor. You focus on the living labor, which is the one that transforms raw material and part of the machinery into the new product. Okay, so how does Marx resolve the issue? The commodity labor power that the worker sells to the capitalist has this specific property. What is the property that it has? Suppose the worker is working for 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day. Now, suppose in the entire day's work, 12 hours of work, the worker only adds 12 hours of labor time, but it takes 12 hours of labor time to produce the worker. Then there's nothing left for the capitalist. So the reason the capitalist is able to get surplus value is that the labor power the worker sells to the capitalist has this property that the amount of labor time required to produce labor power is much less. In other words, the value of labor power measured in labor time is much less than the length of the working day. Capitalist has hired my labor power. The condition of employment is that I must work for 10 or 12 hours as the case may be. But the wage I get, which is enough to reproduce my family by assumption, although capitalists may not even sometimes give you that wage, they may starve you, may starve your family, but let's assume that we have all that taken care of and that capitalist gives me a wage that enables me to reproduce myself and my family. How much time do I need to do that? How much time is required to produce all the things that I need to keep my family going? Well, this is clearly much less than the length of the working day. My living, you know, obviously I don't live like a capitalist. Right? The worker lives at a different level of existence. So for the worker's level of existence, whatever is required to produce and reproduce that labor power takes one part of the working day. In other words, you can divide the working day under capitalism into two parts. If the worker were, you know, not dependent on the capitalist, but had all of nature to himself, he would still have to work for a certain amount of time, produce his own labor power. And that is the necessary labor time. Still have, in any way, he would have had to work for a certain amount of time to produce whatever he and his family needs. So one part of the working day becomes necessary labor time. So the labor time required to reproduce labor power. But the worker can't exit saying, Professor Atre has taught me that you, whatever you have paid me, I worked for it. No, because what you sold the capitalist is labor power. And the contract says that he's entitled to use your labor power for the whole day. He's entitled to use your mental and physical energies for the whole working day. That is a deal, right? And you went in under the understanding. In other words, it's very important to understand this seriously because it means that the worker and the capitalist, theoretically, we are visualizing them as two independent individuals meeting and entering into an agreement. Don't think of the reality of India, which is much worse, but think of an ideal situation where the worker is an independent individual, the capitalist is hiring the worker. There's a deal. They've made an agreement, right? A contract. But once the worker enters the factory, democracy ends there. Until that point, the worker and the capitalist are two equal human beings, individuals, legal rights, and they enter into a contract. But once I've entered into a contract, for that working day, I have sold my labor power to the capitalist. Now it is up to the capitalist to use my labor power as he sees fit. So the contract says you must work from 8 to 6 in the evening, 8 a.m., 6 p.m., with a break for lunch or whatever. So I can't get out of it by saying, no, you, whatever wage you've given me, I have, can be produced in about 6 hours or 5 hours or 4 hours. So I'm now leaving. No, you can leave, but you can't come back the next day. So clearly the contract requires the worker to work the whole day, but the amount of labor time required to reproduce labor power is much less than a full working day. This is what makes surplus possible. The word surplus value that the capitalist gets is nothing but surplus labor time that the worker works for the capitalist. And in other words, it is the difference between the length of the working day and the value of labor power measured in labor time. Just in 4 or 5 hours, the remaining 4 or 5 hours, you continue to work anyway because that is a contract. And the product that is thus created belongs to the capitalist. And when that is sold, it becomes money form of surplus. It is commodity form before it is sold, and it is money form once it is sold. Since the capitalist class owns the means of production, it gets to appropriate that surplus. In other words, what the capitalist class appropriates is on account of its ownership of the means of production, not on account of any contribution it makes to the production process, because all of that is taken care of by the managers who, you know, organizing production, coordinating it, all the rest of it is done by the managers. The owners just own. It is true that some of the managers may have stock options, so they may partly own the company. That's a different matter. But the labor of production and reproduction is distinct from the fact of ownership of property. And we must recognize that surplus value is not a return to effort of any kind. It is the outcome of the fact that the capitalist class owns the means of production, and therefore it gets to appropriate the surplus value. Of course, in the real world, the capitalist class may not get to appropriate all of it itself. It has to share it with, as I said, the wholesale merchant, the bank which lent him money, the landlord who gave him factory space, etc., etc. But that's all their problem. It's all a question of distribution of surplus among the property classes. But looking at it in terms of the working class and the property class, the working class and the capitalist class, not in terms of an individual factory, but in terms of the entire system, you look at it in class terms, what you find is that the secret of surplus value lies in the fact that it takes less time to produce labor power in comparison with the length of time for which labor power can actually work, can actually provide labor. So it provides 10, 12 hours of labor, but it takes only about 6 hours of labor time to produce it. Extra money, extra time, therefore, becomes the property of the capitalist. So this is something that, I think if you go back, and right now it will be abstract for you because it's all words, not even diagrams. But if you go back and read the text of the chapter, then you will understand. So summarize it, basically, in the capitalist labor process, the worker enters the process having entered into a contract with the capitalist, who has, in our assumption, fairly and squarely, without any cheating, paid the worker the value of labor power. But the value of labor power is only the amount of labor time required to reproduce the worker's family and his immediate needs. That is done, taken care of. Given the levels of productivity we have today, it would probably hardly take 2 hours of labor time to produce what the working class wage is. So the surplus is huge. It's important because you think of, for example, people in IT who get paid relatively higher salaries. Now, we should not make the mistake of thinking that just because they get paid higher salaries, they are less exploited. No, because the amount of surplus they provide for the capital, probably far greater than the amount of wages they get in the contracts that these capitalists make. So, we're not looking at this in terms of levels of salaries or incomes. In fact, you must also understand that if productivity improves in society, then the worker can be better off in terms of the wages he gets, in terms of the command over commodities he can purchase. And the capitalist can still get more surplus labor time because what the time required to produce the higher wage of the worker is now less than it used to be because of the improvement in productivity. So that hinges on productivity itself. And we'll come back to this question of what role productivity increases play in the generation of surplus value. We'll come back to that later. But for this class, I'm practically at the end of my time. Just to summarize, we are saying that the key circuit of capital that drives capitalism is the circuit MCM prime. The vast majority of people engage in the other circuit of commodities, which is CMC prime. I sell my labor power, get a wage and spend it and go back to work again. CMC prime. But the capitalist begins with money and it multiplies. In the old days, it would multiply by money lending alone or by trade alone. But that is only at the expense of other people. Now, today, it multiplies, not just in money terms, but in terms of new assets, new buildings, new machines, new factories that the capitalist owns, new palatial bungalows the capitalist builds for himself. But all that becomes possible because of the very specific nature of the commodity labor power, which requires less time to produce it. But is available for a greater length of time as labor. It provides labor for a longer time, but it can be produced in half a day's work or two-thirds of a day's working time. And that difference between what we call necessary labor time, namely the labor time required to produce labor power, and the full length of the working day. That remaining part of the working day then can be called surplus labor time. So the working day can be divided into necessary labor time and surplus labor time. And that surplus labor time expressed in the, you know, expressed in the form of a surplus of commodity that capitalist sells, surplus income, M becomes M prime. But underlying that basically is this fact that labor power as a commodity has this unique property that it can create more value than is required to reproduce it. And that is where surplus value arises. I think we will stop here for the time being because I think it's quite a lot for a day. I'm just about finishing my 1 hour, but let me again emphasize that we are not discussing this in terms of one factory, one capitalist, the workers under the capitalist, because a particular factory may even make losses, a particular company may even make losses, but take society as a whole. Take it in terms of these two broad classes, capitalist class and the class of working people. What we observe is that year after year, working people work. I mean, the worker, when he goes into the factory, does not imagine he's going to be buying up the factory, right? But year after year, the property with the capitalist class keeps growing larger and larger. Of course, some capitalists will lose out in the process. They join the ranks of the workers. So the class of surviving capitalists diminishes all the time in terms of numbers or in terms of shares of the population. But the wealth that they possess grows. And it comes from where? It comes from the surplus value they're able to appropriate by virtue of their ownership of the means of production. And that becomes possible because of the extraordinary property of the commodity labor power, which is able to generate more value, work for a longer period of time than is required to reproduce it. It would obviously make no sense for the capitalist to hire a worker if all that the worker could do was to reproduce the wage that the capitalist paid him. Then the capitalist would get no surplus. So, you know, the very fact that capitalism generates profits and these profits then get reflected in real assets which are growing to the credit of the capitalists must tell you that this is where the crux of the matter is. So I think we'll stop here. Go back and read chapters 2, 3 and 4 carefully. I've not gone into the question of the origins of capitalism, all of which is dealt with in those chapters, although I'd hope to do that, but I think it'll be difficult to cover all of that. So this is a very, very dense presentation, but that is going to be the case with every day's presentation. I'm summarizing a lot of material into 1 hour. So I'm going to ask you to read the material, keep generating questions. I'm not going to answer questions now because I'll need to collect them and then sift them. And then at some point, we'll spend one session perhaps for dealing with questions that have come. Maybe after a day or two, after a couple of more sessions. So I will stop here.